All right, thanks all for coming. I mean, I'm very happy that you all think that the closed time path cosmism is more interesting than black holes and information. What I'm going to tell you, I'm mainly going to follow the way how it's presented in these two papers here. This is kind of review by Berges, and this is our own paper. I have to admit that neither Berges nor us invented these things, so they are not original references. They are simply the notation that I follow in this talk. And I put a bunch of more references on this wiki. Of course, they're not complete, and I fear that I probably overrepresented my own work, but okay, for your information, this, you can have a look there if you're interested. Okay, so what's the motivation for what I'm going to talk about today? It's non-equilibrium processes in the early universe. And okay, these are often being described by Boltzmann equations. And so classically, if you think about an ensemble of particles, how it can be described, it's usually being described by a phase-based distribution function. And if you start very, very generally in statistical physics, the phase-based distribution function, let's call it rho, it is a function of the positions and the momenta of all particles. All right? So if you have an everyday life system that's like 10 to the 23 particles, and if you have the early universe that's even much more, I guess. So this is a function of a very, very large number of variables. And the this function follows this Liouville equation that's sort of like this. Rho dt equals some. Well, this is the Poisson bracket. I mean, this is just the normal Liouville equation. So this is not very practical because you have this function of a very enormous number of variables. So what you do is there's this thing called the BBGKY hierarchy, which stands for Bogoliubov, Born, Green, Kirkwood, and Ebon, however you pronounce it. And you can break that down in a set of sort of recursive relations of functions with less variables, so you have an infinite tower. So after that, instead of having this function with very many variables, you have an infinite tower of where you start with a single particle distribution function, the two particle function, and so on and so on and so on. And for most practical applications, it's sufficient to truncate that tower and just look at the single particle distribution function. So the single particle distribution function is just a function of one momentum and one position. Of a single particle. And of course, there's some truncation when you go from here to there, but for most practical purposes, that's sufficient. And of course, if you have more than one particle species in your system, you might have put an index alpha here because you have more than to indicate the distribution function of which particle species you need.
So why is it okay to just have single particle distribution function? It seems like better than cash.
It depends. I think it depends on what variable you want to look at. So
what are we trying to compute here?
Okay, it has to do with this Boltzmann H3 model. For example, if you look at this, this doesn't have any memory of the past. So how can I say? Okay, I'm drawing a picture now. I'm not sure if this picture is entirely correct, but let's take an ensemble. Take a bunch of particles that are coming in. Some of them are colliding with each other. They do some stuff. And okay. And in principle, this final state here is characterized by a number of variables for all these particles, and it depends on all the history of this system. Okay? But if you believe in, well, not a question of belief, it's a question of approximations, you know, in Boltzmann's ideas, then essentially, if you have a weakly coupled system, it will not remember its memory. So this collision here is essentially just a two-particle collision that doesn't remember all the details of essentially all these variables that were in the previous history. So that is, you can characterize the system kind of locally in space and time here. And for this collision, you can say all that matters is by which momentum does this particle come in, which momentum does that particle come in. So you only need sort of the probability distribution to describe such a one collision. You only need to know, okay, what is the probability distribution of particles to come in with a certain momentum in a collision? And that sort of corresponds to the fact that you can isolate this collision from the whole, from the rest of the
So the single system. Particle distribution function describes
that.
The single collision.
Well, the single particle distribution function describes the system in the approximation, and I'm going to say a bit more about that later, that essentially there's no memory of the past, and there's no memory of the past, and each collision is individual. Like, there's no correlation between these different collisions with each other. So you say that even though we have a very huge ensemble, in principle, in this very huge ensemble, all sorts of things are correlated. So what happens here is correlated to what happens there, because in principle it's a deterministic system, so the memory is being preserved over the past. You can say, I can, in very good approximation, understand the system by just treating these things as isolated events involving a small number of particles.
This is tracing one particle? Because you don't have the brackets around x and b.
Exactly. But that's what I'm saying, is that if you have the function that depends on all variables, so essentially then if you treat the time evolution, it takes the positions of all particles as input parameters go into the time evolution. Well, if I isolate this collision, then I say for this collision here, it doesn't matter what two particles are over here doing, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the physical picture, I think.
I think you're right to say that any one of the incoming particles into those collisions is equivalent to any other one because there is no memory. So you can just pick one out of the ensemble and treat it as a distribution that's characteristic of any one of the incoming states of a given set of quantum numbers.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it. That's a good way to say it. You don't need to know which particle is colliding with which one. You don't need to say this is this first particle John and this is particle N or whatever. You just say a generic particle collides, as Michael said. So you don't need to know what each particle is doing. You don't just need to know what the average particle is doing. All right. So that's the whole philosophy behind this. And so what you get then is an equation of motion that, okay, let's assume we are in the universe for this function. So dTf, and we have plus 3 alpha equals some prefactor, assuming that there are no internal degrees of freedom. And then there's a collision term, which is essentially a function or a functional of all distribution functions. So if you say that there's more than one particle species, so alpha is my particle species that I should keep track of, then this is the expansion of the universe. I mean, now I think it added the expansion of the universe to the equation of motion because this is what we're mainly interested in, early universe, I guess, in this workshop. And then there's this side, which is a collision term that depends not only on this function, but on the distribution function for all particle species.
Is it the momentum average distribution?
No, not yet. You can write x, d.
Let's talk to the operator to do some d by dt.
Ah, yeah, that's true. It's probably true if I put this in this form.
Yeah.
Yes, I think I assume that. Yes, that's true. That's true. Okay. Yeah. And if you, that's true. Otherwise, you have this dp, ddx, you have this individual things. Yes, that's true. I assume I did the momentum average.
And how is that different from the Boltzmann equation?
That is the momentum average Boltzmann equation.
Yeah,
that is the Boltzmann equation.
Yeah, actually. Okay.
That's what I'm saying. The equation of motion for this quantity looks somehow like that after some momentum averaging procedure in this case. And so now there's something. Now you already can see that this is a, okay. This kind of equation is perfectly fine for many processes in cosmology. For example, the decoupling of the CMB, and it's fine for BDN.
Sorry, I have a question about this momentum averaging. So the F depends on P, right? So
initially,
what sense, what sense are you doing momentum averaging there? Is it
okay?
Alpha has an average of momentum, so it depends.
Yes.
The collision term has integrals over all of the beta momenta, but you're also doing an additional integral of the alpha.
Yes. Yes. So this collision term.
But you can write it before and after doing the.
You don't have to do the momentum.
Yeah.
You don't have to. Do it. No.
Okay.
But then there's an extra set of derivatives to come in with the flow in and out of the phase space.
Exactly.
Of momentum p alpha.
when I prepared the talk, I wasn't, I jumped immediately from here to there without thinking much of it. But usually you would have some ddp and ddx terms here. But if you average the momentum, this all collapses. And if you're in a Friedmann Robinson model, space time, this all collapses to this simple expression of the h. In general, yeah, you can.
So those are more like total number density, n alpha and.
Yeah. I should call this n maybe. To be less n alpha. Yes. Okay, you can, but you can write down the very. I mean, the point that I'm going to make, you can also make it for the f. But it's a good point. I mean, it was a good remark. So many systems of cosmology can be described by this kind of.
What is the W or omega? What is this?
Energy. Sorry, this is just energy. But you can also absorb that in there, I guess. I mean, it depends on how you define. This is the energy of the particle. So if you assume this is an on-shell particle, this would be p squared plus m squared. Square root. The point is that if you have a dilute gas, this is a perfectly fine description of things. So this is a semi-classical description in the following sense, that what you have on this side is classical, and what you have on this side, the collision term you would get from the S matrix, from there, that is quantum. Okay? So that's why it's a semi-classical description. And as I said, this is very fine for any system that is a dilute gas. Like, now, I will specify what I mean by dilute in a second. The problem with this, why it doesn't always work, is that there are certain effects that it cannot capture. For instance, it cannot capture coherent phenomena, quantum coherence, for example, flavor oscillations. Maybe also other phenomena, I don't know. Then it doesn't capture any memory.
What do you mean by flavor oscillations?
For example, neutrino oscillations.
So when you work on a mass basis, wouldn't that be okay? You work always on a mass basis instead of the gauge basis, wouldn't it?
No, but you might have, okay, if
it's the gauge basis on the right hand side.
You don't have to choose that, right? You can choose a mass basis everywhere. Mm-hmm. Right? Probably would do it like the way like
you. Yes, but you have off-diagonal correlations. I mean, you have off-diagonal correlations between different flavors, because if you diagonalize the mass term, then the interaction term is not going to be, the collision term is not going to be diagonal with flavor space. If you diagonalize the collision term, then the mass term is not going to be diagonal. So either ways, you will create coherent sets of coherences between two different flavors. Since this is just a single flavor quantity, just as an index, this is a particle, an electron. It cannot be half electron, half muon, so to say, neutrino. Because of that, with this kind of treatment, you cannot capture this coherence between two different flavors. And this generally occurs because you cannot simultaneously diagonalize the mass and the interaction term. Okay, so you have this, so memory effects are not captured. Okay, sometimes you might have a finite width effect, because you have some unstable particles that have a finite width, but here it's always assumed that the particle is just a classical on-shell particle. And most importantly, in my opinion, is this problem that I call never far away. So this never far away problem is exactly what I mean by dilute gas. So now I can draw the picture again that I drew before. In this, let's draw something. So these are particles. They come in, they collide, either elastically like here or inelastically like there, or can simply decay the unstable particles. But the basic assumption of the Boltzmann equation is that these collisions are isolated events. So essentially, the particle here collides in a way that is described by the S matrix, quantum field theory, but in between they propagate freely, like free classical particles. And then if you say the assumption is that if you calculate these things by S matrix elements are calculated with asymptotic state. That means state is projected to infinite past, infinite future. And that works very well if the time that passes between two interactions is very, very long compared to the interaction time or any other time scale. So you can say, here you have particles coming from past infinity going to future infinity. And that's what I mean by dilute plasma. And that if the plasma, and if this justification is, if this assumption is justified, I call it a dilute plasma. However, if you go back in the history of the universe, the plasma becomes more and more dense. So the more and more dense this plasma becomes, the worse this assumption becomes. So essentially, the particles are never far away from each other in the sense that the plasma is so dense that the particle always feels the presence of its neighbors. And then it cannot be described in an S matrix. Because an S matrix assumed that, in the S matrix formulation, you assume that at some point, well, in the very distant past, in the very distant future, you can essentially project everything onto three asymptotic states. And the asymptotic states are defined without interaction. Because in a particle collision, in a particle collider, for example, the particles collide at some point and then they move away. And once they're very, very far away from the collision center, they essentially don't feel each other anymore and they can be projected on these asymptotic free states. But that doesn't work here because there's plasma everywhere, and at some point, if the density is high enough, the particles will always feel the presence of the plasma, and it's quite ambiguous how to define asymptotic states in such an environment, or whether asymptotic states are a useful concept in this environment. So that's what I mean by never
power. Is this like a non-linearity of the system happening, or?
Non-linearity.
Distortion of the wave function, right? Like the free wave function is not a good approximation anymore.
Yes, exactly. That's maybe a good way to say.
I mean, is this different than just saying there's a problem if you have strong coupling?
It's not strong coupling. This, well, okay, there are different levels of problems. I mean, if you come to the point that the theory is really strongly coupled, then what I'm going to do to show you is practically not.
It's not necessarily strongly coupled, but I mean, there's another. I don't know whether it goes in one of your bullets or not, but if the background field that gives mass to the particles is changing with space-time, then the asymptotic state there isn't, because the mass is changing with space-time. So what you call your mass eigenstate, you're not, you know, and so there you're sort of decohering into an infinite power space, not because you have strong coupling, but because you have a space-time varying background field.
So that's one way. That's one way. What can happen, for example, if you have a space-time varying background field, then you do not know how to define your asymptotic state. If there, let's say, you have an oscillating field to which the particle comes.
Another thing, just a bubble wall. If you're moving through the profile where it's changing, where it's I mean, there is an asymptotia, but during the interaction region, you can't treat each interaction as an S matrix.
And another thing is, if you're at high temperature, for instance, it's you have this thing called. Okay, let's assume we're in equilibrium at high temperature. Then you have this thing called thermal masses, which means that the dispersion relation of the particle is not the same as in vacuum. So the propagating state is not the same. So the plasma wave doesn't have the same dispersion relation as the particle would have in vacuum. So the quasi-particle that moves there, it's not a good approximation.
Quantum particles were actually why I was asking. This is like quantum critical phenomena or something.
Yeah, if you have a weakly coupled theory, but at high temperature and density, you can capture everything by quasi particles. Because you can say that even though these particles are never really asymptotic, you can sort of form a quasi particle by the particle plus interaction. But that only works if you have a weakly coupled theory. If you have a strongly coupled theory, then you cannot do this quasi particle approximation. And because of that, it's two different things to say something is strongly coupled or to say I need to do what I'm going to talk about. Because if it's weakly coupled, then I can still imply perturbation theory even in this regime that I will talk about, and then you can define quasi-particles. If it's a strongly coupled theory, then you cannot do the quasi-particle approximation, and then you really have to do lattice physics or lattice speculations or something like that. But I'm going to talk about alternative methods.
Which of these the things that you can't use Boltzmann equations for can be incorporated as corrections?
Sorry, once again?
Can you incorporate any of these like problems just as corrections to the semi-classical?
Yes and no. I mean, it depends on what you call Boltzmann equation. I mean, you can derive, using the formalism that I'm going to show you, as Björn will probably show you later, you can derive a set of kinetic equations using this formalism. And you can call those Boltzmann equations if you want. But these are, it's a difference whether I just take sort of the classical Boltzmann equation, insert the S-matrix element, or whether I start from the non-equilibrium quantum field theory within this framework, define some kind of dynamical variable, and then derive some Boltzmann-looking-like equations for these dynamical variables. And the difference is that in the second case, you can sort of derive these kinetic equations using a number of consistent approximations, controlled approximations, and you have a scheme how to calculate the coefficients in the Boltzmann equation. But in this sort of quantum Boltzmann, you can call that quantum Boltzmann equations, maybe.
Okay.
So that's what Björn is going to talk. I think Björn is going to talk about how from this very, what I'm going to show you is a very, okay, it's a very first principles thing. And from this first principles thing, you can use controlled approximation to derive quantum kinetic equations that formally look like Boltzmann equations, but they're more consistent and include some of these corrections. Because in the framework of Boltzmann equations, you would have to guess the corrections, essentially, which is not very reliable. But in this framework, you can derive the quantum kinetic equations from first principles, and you know what the corrections of Boltzmann equations are. Does it make sense?
Maybe one remark is what you just said about isolating these scatterings when particles in a Feynman diagram propagate on the Mars shell or close to the Mars shell. Then you don't have to have really physically dilute gas, but the virtuality of the process is low, so you have a long time scale associated with it, and then you run into problems typically. So these would be infrared effects, soft and collinear divergences, and also CP violation.
So, okay, now I'm coming to what I'm actually going to talk about after finishing what I'm not going to talk about. That is the non-equilibrium QFT. All right. So quantum field theory is simply, I'm not much louder than I was before.
When you stand right there, there's some speaker or something. That was
okay.
Actually when I was
doing so the quantum field theory is just the quantum mechanics of continuous systems. So maybe you can in principle apply quantum statistical quantum field theory works in some sense in the same way as statistical quantum mechanics, because after all it's just quantum mechanics of continuous systems. So you can define this density operator that you're probably familiar with from quantum mechanics of some statistical ensemble. So you have some quantum states that I label by some number I, and they're this density matrix or quantum density operator, or that's called quantum mechanics. So this object here. And this object can be seen as the equivalent to this full phase-based distribution function. And in fact, it follows a very similar equation of motion. It follows the von Neumann equation or quantum de Weil equation. Okay, now I'm going to head here, which I probably will forget later. But, so this equation formally looks extremely similar to the de Weil equation, just with the difference that this is now a commutator and not a Poisson bracket. So this is the von Neumann equation. And this gives you the time evolution of this guy here. And now, once you know the time evolution of this guy, you can calculate all observables. So the expectation value of any observable is being calculated as a trace. So it's calculated as this. We have any operator, like let's say any operator, and the expectation value is calculated like this. And this way to calculate the expectation value contains both a quantum averaging and a statistical averaging over the initial conditions that are encoded in these coefficients pi. So perfect. In principle, we are finished now and we can all go home. I mean, now in principle, we have understood how it works. However, the problem is that this guy has an infinity times infinity matrix. So it's very hard to deal with that in practice. So So in order to make any practical calculation, you have to break that down somehow. Just as we did here, we broke this function of 10 to the 23 variables down to something of one or two variables. We do the same thing here. And
the states I are.
Sorry, once again?
Do you know what the states I are?
Oh, this is just a...
I realize I understand the formalism, but...
This is just some set, some basis. You choose a basis in Hilbert or Fock space. This is just from quantum mechanics. Choose a basis.
We don't know the states because it's not free particle field theory anymore.
You still can write down a complete set of states. It's just that the, you're still in Fock. It's just that the single particle states may not be a good description of your physical reality at that point. But formally, you can still decompose your, you can still find a complete basis in Fock space.
All right. I probably forgot my quantum mechanics, but why is this trace the right way of defining the expectation value?
I forgot how to prove this, but this is, I can give you an arrogant answer now to say, this is just
in a basis where the operator in the Hamiltonian say that are simultaneously diagonalized, and it's just the product of the eigenvalues times it up. Okay, so that's the trace.
Okay. There you go.
And then it doesn't matter what basis you're in, once you've written the trace.
So if I just insert that guy there, right? You can see it back there. If I insert this expression for rho in there, then I get here sum over j and I, and then this gives you a Kronecker delta, and then you essentially have the sum over the expectation. So you essentially have this gives you Kronecker delta. The sum over the expectation values weighted with it. I think I'm going too slow anyway. But you're asking many questions, so that's a good thing. All right, so what you can do instead of looking at this infinite dimensional matrix is to look at all endpoint functions of the field. So now, for simplicity, going to use a real scalar field as an example, but everything I say can also be done for any other kind of field. And for a real scalar field, we, for example, have the one-point function, or classical field, which is simply the expectation value of a, defined in this way. And then we have a two-point function, but we actually have two different two-point functions that are independent. We have one two-point function that is like this. And yet we have another two-point function. We have another two-point function like that. And then we would have three-point function, four-point function, and so on and so on. It's an infinite tower just like over there. And there's only one-point function. There are two different two-point functions. In equilibrium and in vacuum, these two would not be independent. So first of all, in thermal equilibrium or in vacuum, so vacuum is kind of a special case of thermal equilibrium with zero temperature, these functions would only depend on the difference x minus y. They would only depend because of translation invariance. And moreover, there's a relation between these two. So there's only one propagator in vacuum. But in a non-equilibrium system, these two functions are actually two independent functions, and also they depend on these two variables independently, not only on the difference, also on the sum. And, from these two correlation functions that are called the Whiteman functions, you can construct all other possible two-point functions that you can think of. For example, the Feynman propagator, you can construct as a So this theta function just does the time ordering. So this is how you can construct the Feynman propagator. Or, for example, another one that is very useful is what I call delta minus. It's simply I. So instead of using these two independent variables for the two-point functions, I can use this set here. And this is called the spectral function. And this is called the statistical propagator. And what is very nice about these two is that they have a physical interpretation. So the poles of this function give you the the excitations in the plasma. So this function has a pole structure, and this pole structure gives you the spectrum of causal particles. And that is done without any reference to asymptotic states or so. It's just a correlation function. This correlation function, as you can see, is defined without any reference to asymptotic state of free particles or whatever. And the poles of this function give you sort of the quasi-particle spectrum without having to refer to the asymptotic states. And this function.
Vacuum there?
Sorry?
The zero temperature vacuum? Or the expectation value is taken with respect to what?
Well, the expectation value is with always that. All expectation. So in everything I write from now on, all expectation values are always taken this way. So that of course, you can choose vacuum here. You just choose. You can choose. The vacuum is included. You can choose just this thing just being the vacuum. The zero state,
yeah,
exactly.
Okay. So if I could make one other comment, those are in states, right? This is not in to out, right? Which is another way of saying you're not using an S matrix.
Yes, but there's no in or out state at all so far, right? I mean, I just choose some basis. I can define this in any kind of a basis in Hilbert space without specifying my initial conditions for the system, physical initial conditions,
right.
Yet. And define this.
Often people talk about these as n matrix elements.
Yes, I find that a bit confusing, but this is called an informalism, and we'll see in a second why.
Oh, you're going to talk about that.
But at this stage, I don't refer to any in or out states yet. I just choose some basis in Hilbert space. And okay, and so while this guy gives you the spectrum of propagating states, so to say, this guy gives you the occupation numbers for these. And all observables can be, okay, in principle, there are also 3, 4, 5, and so other endpoint functions, but I'm going to forget about these, ignore these for the moment, because most quantities that you will ever be interested in can be expressed in terms of 1 and 2 point functions.
I have a dumb question. How did you calculate the p's again?
P's.
And the definition of
rho. Ah, these are my initial conditions. So you have some quantum state, and this is an ensemble. This quantity represents.
I mean, in practice, to calculate those, don't you have to know?
You don't calculate, I mean, your initial conditions? Okay. When you solve non-equilibrium problems, it's an initial value problem, essentially. Say I know the state of my system at some initial time, and then I want to see how the system evolves.
I guess what I'm asking, isn't that the statement that you're looking at the NN? Because.
Yes.
Because that's your initial conditions, right?
Yes, yes. That's the boundary condition, exactly. So you can call that in states. That's probably that's what Michael was referring to. You can call that in state, but the reason why I don't like this so much is because you don't refer to any asymptotic state here, because in
not necessarily in the infinite past.
Exactly.
But usually in, you know, year one field theory, you teach infinite past and infinite future. The in state is the initial condition, what you make, you know, what comes out of the accelerator for the scattering. But here you're taking an average over one set of states that aren't related to each other by the asymptotic.
Exactly, and the difference is that these are just boundary conditions formulated at some finite time.
Okay.
Of course, this is the initial value, but I don't like to call it in-state because then people get confused with the infinite past.
That's why I was asking. Okay, good.
A set of places. So I'm just to take. So now, okay. First of all, most quantities that you'll ever be interested in charges and so can be computed in terms of 1 and 2 point functions. So let's only look at those now. And now to illustrate the physical meaning of these, as I said, this guy gives you the spectrum of quasi particles in the plasma. And this guy gives you the propagation number. So for example, for a scalar field, I can calculate the energy density. So I can do, let's assume we have a homogeneous system, homogeneous and isotropal. For simplicity, then I can do a Fourier transform and calculate it in space, not in time, because we have a time-dependent problem. So that homogeneous and isotropic in space. I can do a Fourier transform in space. Then I can, for example, calculate the energy density of this field phi as a function of time. As this, you use this operator. You'll see in a second. So m, let m be the mass of the scalar field and q the momentum mode that we are looking at.
So by mass, do you mean the Lagrangian mass?
Lagrangian mass. Lagrangian mass, yeah. The way how the pole later on comes, I mean, okay, if you do practical calculations, the way how the pole mass from this comes in is that you do phase-based integrals over things, and then things get put on shell by the phase-based integral. So you integrate over the zero component, and then the pole puts things on the mass shell. And then that will be the mass shell that is determined by that function up there, and that mass shell will include all medium effects. Okay, I don't know if you can read it because it's kind of behind this thing. Is my writing sort of readable? So this is partial derivative. Lines 2-1. Okay, so you can essentially express the energy density. This is time derivatives plus this on-shell things. I mean, momentum squared plus m squared. You can express it in terms of this quantity and the classical field. So that shows you that this quantity gives you sort of the occupation number, because that gives you the contribution from this mode to the energy density. All right? And in the limit, when all these quantum effects are negligible, this energy density, up to some vacuum energy correction, converges towards the normal energy density that you would get from the Boltzmann equation. So this reproduces the Boltzmann equation in some sense, in the limit of a dynamic gas. All right. So now we have a very nice setup of different of ways to describe things. However, to practically do something, you need to have the equation of motion for these guys, because now we have to find nice functions that allow to express observables in terms of these functions. But first, we need the equation of motions, and that's precisely what this closed time path formalism gives us. So how much time do I have left?
Cookies minus 30 minutes.
Okay. All right, so the goal of this closed time path formalism now, or Schwinger-Keldysh formalism, is to find the equation of motion for these functions that I just wrote down. And for that, we define the correlation functions on a very funny time path, which is the closed time path. So let's say this is the time axis, t, and this is real part of the time, and this is imaginary part of the time. We start at some division. So we start at some initial time ti and go to some time tf, turn around, and go back. And this is just this is ti plus I epsilon. then this is Ti minus I epsilon. Okay, in the end we can send this final time to infinity, it doesn't matter. So what we want to do is we want to calculate, the reason why we do it like this can be intuitively understood like this. We want to calculate correlation functions for real times. So we need to define our generating functions, our correlation functions, somewhere along the real axis, because that's what we're physically interested in. However, we can only formulate boundary conditions at the initial time, because we don't know the state of the system at the final time from the beginning on. So we need to take a contour that goes back to the initial time, simply because we only can formulate boundary conditions here. So the end points of the end and beginning point of the contour must both be at the initial.
Does this mean the system has to be reversible?
Well, quantum mechanics is reversible. But I don't think, I'm not sure how this is if this is related, because this is just, so far this is just a formal step. I mean, I'm not really going backwards in time with this system.
So it doesn't interact with a bath or something, like a thermal bath.
A thermal bath is one special, I mean, this is a very general formalism to treat any equilibrium system. So a setup where you have some non-equilibrium part interacting with a large thermal bath is one possible thing that one can treat with this formula. And that's exactly what we did in this paper as an example. Take this and couple it with thermal bath. But this formalism is more powerful. It can in principle describe any kind of non-equilibrium state. Initial state.
I guess I didn't mean reversible, I meant more adiabatic.
No, it doesn't assume adiabaticity.
It doesn't assume anything. This is just...
Actually, if you assume adiabaticity, then along any point in that evolution, you can, the TF, you can insert a complete set of states. And let's suppose we start at zero temperature, where you have some non-equilibrium, but close to adiabatic process. Insert a complete set of states, and only the vacuum state is going to contribute. And so you've essentially just inserted the S matrix operator times your whatever observable you're calculating, and then the reverse path is just giving you the vacuum matrix element of the S matrix, which then becomes one over, essentially it's the inverse of the S matrix. So it becomes this sort of the normal zero temperature field theory expression where you divide out the vacuum bubbles by clearing that thing in the denominator. And that's if you assume adiabaticity.
When you don't.
When you don't, you can't make that approximation of inserting only the vacuum at any point along the way. And then at finite temperature it changes because you have a non-degenerate spectrum and the same argument breaks down.
So far I haven't made any approximation. I just say I take a quantum field theory and I extend the time to the imaginary. I can, it's like big rotation. You can just, instead of calculating correlation functions for real times, I can extend the time to the imaginary part. It's very similar to big rotation. And now I decide to calculate correlation functions that live on this funny contour in the imaginary time plane. It's not so obvious yet why that makes any sense, but hopefully it will in the end make sense. And then in order to get correlation functions on this contour, I can define a generating function. So I call this contour C, so I call this for generating function C of J and R, for J and R are sources. This generating functional is written as trace, and so this is rho at the initial. And then I have an ordering, time ordering along this contour, okay? And then that's just the action, IS. And to that I add a plus I integral of x. And now to this integral, so I always put this little c. So that means that the spatial part of this four-dimensional integral is just a normal space integral, while the time integration is the one that runs along this contour. That runs from here over up to there. It's just a short notation. Okay, so I have introduced a local source and a non-local source, and here the IS, careful close the bracket. So this is my generating function that I define. And now I can define fields phi plus minus of x equals phi of p plus minus I epsilon and x, of course, okay? So I can just say if my field lives on that part of the contour, I call it phi plus. If my field lives on that part of the contour, I call it phi minus. Just the notation. And then I can find it for this generating functional, I can find a path integral representation that looks like this. Please shout out loud if you can't read anything, because I know that my handwriting is not very good.
You mean the 3-vector in this 5 plus minus x?
Yeah, I mean the 3-vector.
No, on the left side, or maybe it doesn't.
This is a 4-vector, because, okay. So this
maybe
is.
Maybe it doesn't matter.
So x equals t.
Oh, I see. And then the plus tells me that I just add.
Yeah, the plus tells me that
I get it. Yeah.
This plus minus just says for the time component I'm up or down. So formally, I can treat the fields on this on that part of the contour as two different sets of fields that live on one half or the other half.
Yeah.
That's what I'm doing here. And now I define this generating functional. So here I. Okay, I'll omit the space thing, spatial index, variable. Repeat the whole exponential up there. So essentially the plus here, this path integral over the plus ones is just a trace, and here I've inserted the unity. So you see this first integral with this two guys is just path integral representation of the trace, and I've chosen to put a, so this is a, just the one. I've inserted a one there.
So why do we need a non-local source ID in that?
Okay. This we don't necessarily need, but it's convenient. Because this will be the one way to derive the equations of Walsh is to use the so-called two-particle irreducible generating functional, which is different from the one particle reducible because it's essentially the same thing, just you need to cut two lines. And if you want to derive that, then it makes sense to do if you have this kind of source. I think you can do the whole thing without that source in principle. It's not a necessary requirement, I believe. And now I can find a, okay, this part here, this guy here. Can you read when I write here? This guy I can write as a path integral with these boundary conditions. Okay. That means that the entire path integral can be written like this. The entire generating functional can be written like this. Hear you're yawning. I hope that's not serious.
It was me, it's not serious. Half-life is depressing.
Also, you know everything that I say, so. And in the exponential, I again have all these things. So now, what is very nice about this expression is that essentially this here is the initial conditions. And that is sort of an ensemble average. Well, this part here, I mean, this part in degree here accounts for the usual quantum average. All right, so there's two types of averagings in this expression. One is the normal quantum averaging, and the other one is the statistical averaging over the ensemble that we have that we're looking at. So now about these initial conditions. I can write the initial conditions in the following way. Of course, I can formally just write this with some normalization factor, and then exponential I with a function f of phi, where this function f of phi I can write plus I can formally write the initial conditions in terms of such a function. This function can be expanded in terms of these, well, in terms of monomials in the field times some coefficient alpha n that depends on space-time points. And these coefficients alpha n characterize my physical initial conditions. Now, of course, in principle, you can have arbitrarily complicated initial conditions. There's two types, but there's two types of initial conditions where this thing is very particularly simple, and these are the ones what I'm going to focus upon. So the first one is thermal equilibrium. If we have thermal equilibrium initial conditions, then essentially you can write rho like this density matrix like this, e to the minus Hamiltonian divided by temperature. And as you may realize, this thing looks like time evolution operator in imaginary time. So this is thermal equilibrium, just tells you it's just the Boltzmann occupation of states. This is just the Boltzmann factor expressed in an operator way. This is the density matrix for thermal equilibrium, or proportional. And so this looks like a time, this is the Hamiltonian, this is a time evolution operator in imaginary time. So in the case of thermal equilibrium, we don't need actually all of this stuff, because we can completely eliminate this guy from the generating functional by simply, what it does is it essentially evolves the system down here. In thermal equilibrium, we just extend the contour down here and then calculate correlation functions on this extended contour. And this way, we have formally eliminated the initial condition from this expression and have sort of swapped it into the choice of contour, because what this time evolution operator does is just evolve. It makes the contour go down here. And I'm not going to talk about how to do this, because this is just a thermal quantum field theory. And that's, for example, there's this textbook by Leveillac that I put onto the wiki where you can read up how this is done. The second kind of initial conditions that can be handled is Gaussian. That means that initial time, it's sufficient to use one and two-point function to characterize the system. It means that later time, all endpoint correlations functions are going to build up. But the Gaussian initial conditions, then for Gaussian initial conditions, essentially only alpha 0, alpha 1, and alpha 2 are non-zero. And alpha 0 I can absorb into the normalization. Alpha 1 I can absorb into the source J. And alpha 2 I can absorb into the source R. Because you see here you have an exponential. Here you have an exponential of these guys. You multiply it with this exponential here. And then you can, if you only the first three terms in this sum are non-zero, then you can simply absorb them into the normalization parts at these two sources. All right. And now for an L, now I can look at, let's consider for a moment a free theory. So if we assume that this is a free Lagrangian standing in here, in that action, then I can actually solve this path integral down. Where is it? Then I can actually solve this path integral here. And because it's a Gaussian, I mean, it's a Gaussian, it's bilinear in the field, it's a Gaussian path integral, I can solve it. And this can be written, let's take some, it's just right proportional because there's always a normalization. A normalization factor, but it doesn't matter. So this C here indicates that this propagator here lives on the contour. All right, and this delta free is simply the inverse propagator. Okay, so that's for the free case. And now, okay, how much time is there?
15 minutes.
Just 10 minutes.
15.
Ah, very nice.
1:15.
Very nice, very nice. So does that kind of make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, I have a question about this initial Gaussian initial condition.
Yes.
So besides the fact that it's the only thing we can really solve, I mean, easily incorporate, is there some physical interpretation? I mean, you're saying all higher order correlations, more than two
yes.
possible correlations, they're vanishing. Okay, so this
well,
is kind of reasonable for a dilute system.
They don't even need to vanish, they just need to be expressible in terms of the 2-point and 1-point function.
Okay.
So the part of the 3-point function that is not be expressed as a product of a 2-point and a 1-point function. You see what I mean? That part should be negligible at that point.
Yes.
That's the assumption. And I think that's, typically that's valid for many physical systems.
Doesn't that mean there's no interactions?
It's the initial condition.
It's the initial condition, yeah.
So does this basically mean that you're not considering memory effects in this particular?
Sorry, once again, it's considering when
I'm just trying to bring it back to the approximation you were saying before. Does this mean you're not including memory effects because you can use those memory effects?
No. I include memory effects.
Memory effects come precisely because you go along that contour. This is just the slice at T initial.
So I'm
then I'm just trying to get the assumption of Gaussian initial conditions.
This is just, I restrict the set of initial conditions that I put up, because whether or not I include memory effects is something related to the dynamics of my system, related to the equation of motion. So,
you're saying up until the time T0 that memory effects weren't important.
Mm-hmm. I specify my initial condition at some finite time.
Yeah, that's...
It doesn't matter if they were important or not. I just say at this time, I can approximate my system, the physical properties of my system by this
I mean, if it's Gaussian, then you don't have interactions, right? So you,
why you don't have interactions? You just specify.
Because it's not specified in terms of two points.
Oh, you can prepare a quantum system with interaction in a Gaussian state if you want. I mean, I don't know if an experimental is going to do that practically, but it's just a set of just a physical initial state. I mean, if you have.
I mean, after reheating, say, I have a thermal bath.
Yes, yes. I mean, okay, how good this approximation will be depends, of course, on your physical system that you look at. And this formalism also works for non-Gaussian initial conditions, just then it doesn't look as simple. And there are additional terms to those that I will show you here.
So what are the physical conditions that this is the approximation for?
Okay, I'm guessing now. Let's make an educated guess. I would say the educated guess would be that if I can express the global properties of the system, but if I can characterize them well by fixing a limited number of charges or quantum numbers that can be expressed in terms of two-point functions. So let's say if I have a system that can be well approximated by determining the energy density in each mode, the lepton charge in each mode, a finite set of charges, and these charges can be characterized by two-point functions. So then the information that is contained in the two-point function is sufficient to characterize the initial state. Does that make sense? If I can characterize the initial state by charges which are expressed in terms of two-point functions. Of course, the further time evolution of these charges will also involve higher correlation because this is how they interact with each other.
Maybe the assumption is that memory effects don't persist for an infinite amount of time. So it doesn't, at some level, you're insensitive to the initial condition as long as you time evolve long enough that you don't care what the memory was back at t equals zero.
Well, but it doesn't matter what memory effects do. I mean, as long as I can calculate, as long as I can say the state of the system at a given time is well characterized by this set of observables, then it doesn't matter how the system got into this state. But when I want to track the further evolution, then I keep track of these memory effects.
I don't see how you ever get into this state. I mean, if memory effects are important.
Well, inflation needs to be Gaussian initial conditions, right?
That's because there's no interactions initially.
Right.
In the bunch Davies vacuum.
Okay, for that example, it's probably true.
I mean, so Bjorn's going to tell us about leptogenesis. So why is it a good approximation?
For leptogenesis, exactly what I said implies that you have a initial quantum state, that can be well characterized by a temperature and a lepton chemical potential, lepton asymmetry. So this is a small set of charges.
The only time when memory effects start to happen is when the temperature is over the mass of the right-handed neutrino.
No, I just say that I prepare the system at a given state at some time.
But you can't prepare it, right? There's preheating, so you have some thermal bath. I still don't understand what you mean by prepare.
Okay, my physical system is at some point. Okay, let's put it with leptogenesis. Let's stay with the leptogenesis. Okay, for reheating, for inflation, it gives you Gaussian initial conditions. For leptogenesis, the following. There are two different types of leptogenesis. Either leptogenesis happens during production of right-hand neutrinos or during free-thought and decay. If it happens during free-thought and decay, then your initial state is essentially thermal equilibrium. Okay. Because initially your right-hand neutrinos are in equilibrium with everything else, and then that frees out. While if you have the production, then essentially the setup that you have is that initially your right-hand neutrinos are absent because their power coupling is very small, they're not produced in reheating. So you have an initial density matrix that is, in some approximation, rho is a tensor product of a vacuum state for the right-hand neutrinos, tensor, a thermal state for the standard model. Does it make sense? So this is sort of thermalized. It would be the approximation you make. You have a thermalized state for the standard model, and the tensor product with a vacuum with that zero abundance of right-hand neutrinos that you would. Okay, and this is
vacuum is a Gaussian state. Well approximated by Gaussian, and thermal is well approximated.
Exactly. This is not well approximated by Gaussian. Thermal is absolutely not Gaussian. But as we saw before, thermal can also be, I mean, that was this. The thermal part can be taken care of. So thermal initial conditions can be treated like this. And this part is vacuum, which is a Gaussian state. So that's what I'm saying, for the application of leptogenesis, this works, and for the application of for inflation, it also gives you Gaussian things. I think whenever you can characterize your system by finite number of charges, like, for example, leptogenesis would be the limit chemical potential from the temperature. Okay, I think I'm running out of time, but I'm very happy, of course, about all these discussions. So now I've accidentally erased the expression for the free generating function, no? But probably you have written it down. So the general generating functional can be written as usual in quantum field theory. The only difference is that I always have this integral over the contour. And now let V be the potential of the scalar field, so the interaction term. And this is functional derivative with respect to the sources applied to the free one. All right. Okay. And now what I want to do is essentially I still have a quantum field theory that lives on this funny contour. I want to relate that to correlation functions on the real axis. So what I do is, if I have this integral c, d to the power, let's write it here. I can decompose that into a part phi of x. I can cut that into two pieces, essentially an integral from here to there, and another one back. And the right way how I write that is integral to ti tf dt, and of course, these are 3x. Pi plus integral tf dI dt, and of course d to the 3x is always just the normal one, phi minus. And if you remember now, this is a phi times t plus I epsilon and this is t minus I epsilon. Okay? So I can express it like this, and if I swap the integration limits here, so ti, tf, dt, dx, plus of x minus integral. So I can put it like this. Now I can set this to infinity. And now these fields, phi plus and phi minus, they live on the real axis because this sort of contour, the fact that they're a little bit up and a little bit down has been taken care of by the definition of these fields, with the plus ix and the prescription. So these guys are fields that just live on the real axis. And if I express the generating functional in terms of these fields, I can write it like this. And now I drop this contour index because now the generating functional lives on the real axis. And the same thing, what I did for the field, I also do for the sources. I also define sources j plus and j minus. They're defined in the same way. So j plus lives as a t plus I epsilon, j minus is a t minus I epsilon. Minus. So this minus sign comes precisely from this minus sign. Okay, it's a bit formal at this stage. I hope I haven't lost it. times the free generating function. Okay, so now this A and B, a sum over A and B. So A and B can be plus and minus. So I have all different combinations because I have a double integral here, so I have four terms. So I have J plus times delta plus plus times J plus times delta plus minus times J minus, and so on. Where delta plus minus is defined simply as delta AB equals is the correlation function where the AB just says if this is plus then the first argument is on the upper part of the on the plus part of the contour. If this is minus then the first argument is on the lower part of the contour. So these indices IB just indicate where the first and second argument live. So now we have a quantum field theory that is defined on the real axis. So these all these we don't have the contour anymore, but we have two different.
Sorry, but you just said they're defined on the contour.
Okay. Yes. Yes. Okay. Let's put it like that. I have defined this new field plus and minus. So on the upper part, anything that is here that I have defined as plus, anything that on the lower part is defined as minus. So formally, I have replaced the one field that is defined on this contour by two fields that are defined on just the real axis from Ti to Tf, which is equal to infinity. So essentially, what I have done, I have doubled the field content in some sense, which seems inconvenient, but the advantage of that is I get rid of this contour and all variables in this new field theory, new formulation are defined just on the real axis. And sort of these indices, they just carry the memory of where they come from. Not memory in the memory effect sense, but just that's where they come from, these indices. Okay. And the funny thing is that what you see here is, you have minus, this theory has twice the field content of the normal, of the original theory. Now, physical fields will always be associated with the part, the guys on the upper part of the contour that runs forward. But in the loops, you will also have the minus fields. So there, you can think of this a little bit like of ghosts or something like that, just auxiliary fields that help you to calculate things. And the funny thing is that because this guy, these things here generate, because this is the free generating functional, and these guys here gave you the vertices. And you see that all there's no vertex that connects the plus to the minus field. So each vertex, because there's no, okay, this guy only has plus terms in the functional derivative, and this guy only has minus terms in the functional derivative. So there will be only vertices that either connect only plus type fields, plus, 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 or there will be vertices that connect minus type fields. But there will be no vertices that has one plus type field and one minus type field. Moreover, each vertex that comes with minus type fields comes with an overall minus sign in the Feynman rules because of this minus sign. So essentially, you get much more Feynman diagrams than normally. So for example, if you have a simplified with three interaction, if you want to calculate the plus-plus propagator, you have a plus field going to a plus field. That's a free propagator with plus to plus. And you have the case where there's a plus field running in the loop, but you also have the case where it's external plus. And so on. They have all possible combinations. You have also plus, minus, plus, plus. Oh, sorry. This is minus because of this minus. And the last one is plus again because you have twice a minus. So each of, so you see that the external fields can always be identified with a plus, but this, for example, would be a plus plus propagator. Here, a plus field propagates from a plus point to a plus point. While this here would be a plus minus propagator, because here you connect a plus point to a vertex that is of the minus type. Okay, so you see when you would have one diagram in the vacuum theory, you suddenly have four diagrams because you have four different combinations of these plus and minus fields. So the fields don't couple to each other, each vertex either has only plus or minus field, but they propagate into each other because you have a delta plus minus propagator. So the plus field starts as a plus and arrives here as a minus, couples to minus. Okay, I hope this is kind of clear what I'm trying to say.
Sorry, you said there are only two 3-point functions that are all plus or all minus?
So I'm calculating the calculating the plus plus propagator. So the external ones always need to be plus, but the internal ones I need to sum over all possibilities. And then you pick up a minus for each time you put a minus vertex. So here you have a minus, here you have a minus. For the last one, you have a plus again because both of these guys are minus, so the minuses cancel each other.
But the point is that you can switch plus to minus. So actually your second, your second diagram, or one, two, three, the third one, the one that's one more over?
This one here?
That one seems wrong because you're using, you're using the minus plus propagator on the top.
So this is the plus minus propagator. This is a minus plus propagator.
Yeah, okay.
This is a minus plus propagator. And this is a plus plus propagator again. And okay, now of course this is very nice. You can calculate Fermi roots like that. The only thing now, you need to know the expressions for these propagators, of course.
So can you diagonalize just plus plus propagators and minus minus propagators and then interacting terms?
Sorry, once again, can I
diagonalize away this mixed propagator? And see the physics in terms of interactions and do that?
Not really. I mean, there are different representations. Instead of choosing this plus plus and minus minus, you can use other linear combinations. But the fact that you have more Feynman diagrams than usually, I don't think you can eliminate it.
That's all because of the evolution of the states. You can't diagonalize that away. It's not an interaction effect. So, it's the bullet list.
Okay, so the last thing, I think, I don't know, probably I have minus 5 minutes or something like that. Okay. Essentially what I have here is a generating functional for field theory defined on the real axis. So I can just apply the standard way I was always done in quantum field theory. Okay. To derive equations of motion from that, essentially a Dyson-Schwinger equation from that. And you have a bit funny field content because you have this plus-minus field, you have a bit of funny vertices because you have these vertices in the minus, but formally you can treat this as a generating function for normal quantum field theory on the real axis. And then you get this Dyson-Schwinger equation, this matrix-valued Dyson-Schwinger equation. So no IB are again plus and minus, and CD are also plus and minus. So essentially, apart from the usual convolution that you have in this kind of Dyson-Schwinger equation, you also have this matrix product here on the right-hand side, where the indices here and the matrices refer to this plus and minus things. And if I apply the differential operator to this, I know that this is the inverse free propagator. So from that, that will be kind of the final equation of this talk. So I apply this operator here. So I have a Dyson-Schwinger equation. I have a matrix-valued Dyson-Schwinger equation for these matrix-valued propagators. And that I can use to calculate the correlation function. And then the last step to make is that one should realize that this, to connect to the things that I defined before to the correlation function, is that this correlation function can be identified with this correlation function. And I said in the beginning that all correlation functions can be expressed in terms of these two Whiteman functions. So I can identify that with these plus minus guys simply because I know that these, okay, what can I say? For these guys, I know that the order, these are not time ordered functions. So the order is fixed as phi times x times phi times y for the Whiteman function. These guys, in principle, are time ordered functions. But because I know that the first argument is on the plus contour, the second argument is on the minus contour, this is sort of, because I know this comes from this, I know that the argument that's on the plus contour part that's originally lived on the plus contour part is always earlier than the one that lived on the minus contour part, simply because the contour runs like this. So because of that, I know that this time order, in principle, coming from a time ordered quantity, can be identified with this one. And once I have this identification, I can use this this Dyson-Schwinger equation, or it's called Kalman-Bain equation. This Dyson-Schwinger equation is actually called Kalman-Bain equation. This matrix valued one, I can use it to determine these quantities, and I can calculate all propagators as I erased but showed before in terms of these two guys. If I had more time, I would also show you how the equations of motions look for this spectral statistical propagator that I introduced before. But okay, I don't want to deprive your cookies for too much longer.